Somebody who knows a lot more about the future of the railways than I do, although I do travel on it, and it costs me a fortune, is Bruce Williamson. He's head of, he speaks for Rail Future. Morning, Bruce.
Morning, Kelvin.
So, briefly go through this, shall we? HS2, what is it just about to be kiboshed?
There's, who knows? I don't have a magic crystal ball, but the knives are definitely out for it. And the latest sort of blow, as I think you mentioned, is that the cost estimates are going north of £100 billion.
Yep.
And that's quite clearly a lot of money.
Yep.
And I think any reasonable government would have to say, well, look, you know, there has to be a limit to how much we can spend on this project. We can't give you a blank cheque. And so, yeah, what might happen, it might go ahead. They might sort of grin and bear it as the costs continue to spiral. They might scrap it completely. Or we might have some sort of slimmed-down version of HS2, maybe just the link to Birmingham, or maybe slower trains, or I don't know.
OK, fine. So, why? I mean, $100 billion, it's too much money. I mean, if they're forecasting $100 billion now, let me just tell you, having looked at Crossrail, which still is 2 years away from being completed, even though it should have been completed a year ago, right? That's spiraled completely out of control in terms of cost. That could be $200 billion. Who knows what it's going to be? They've already said that the cost for HS2, that the housing costs have turned out to be a lot larger, and some of the tunnelling costs have turned out to be a lot larger, and that's what they know before they start digging.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the scope of the project has changed, you know, because extra people, extra tunnels are needed to sort of mitigate the environmental, blah, 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 you know. The soil was not what they planned.
That's true.
You know, in the real world, you know, you can't get everything right first time. And you mentioned Crossrail, of course, and that, you know, that's unfortunate because it reflects badly on the rail industry and on rail projects. I think Crossrail, you know, it's very badly needed, and once it's up and running, we'll love it, and it, you know, we'll have an impact on London, but it sort of damages the case for future projects. I think, you know, believe it or not, sometimes the rail industry gets it right. I think I'm right in saying that HS1 was built on time and on budget, and it's certainly true of some infrastructure projects, but it's just a pity that Crossrail and HS2 are dominating the headlines right now.
Right, so let's have a look at my favourite bêtoir, which is Southwestern Railways.
Yeah.
I've been travelling up and down that line through various marriages for 15 years, or 14 years anyway. I have never known a time when the actual putting up of what the time it was supposed to arrive and the actual time it did arrive were at such variance. It's shocking. It's shocking, and especially at the end of a hard day's work, you come and you look up at the board at Waterloo, and it says delayed, and then some sound you can't really make out where you're at Waterloo. I wonder whether somebody's deliberately talking like this, right? Announces that there has been some kind of signalling problem. How can we have, you know about these things, Bruce, how can we have signalling problems, which are the technological basis of the entire railway business, right? Going back now 150 years, it couldn't have started without signalling problems. How can we have signalling problems today of such gigantic size that people who've worked bloody hard, right, heading home at the end of the day, suddenly discover that something's happened at Portsmouth that's lasted 3 days?
Well, I mean, there's two problems, I suppose. Firstly, we're running a clapped-out railway. The railway, you know, has suffered from decades of underinvestment. So, you know, there's a huge backlog, and you know, modern signalling systems, or even, you know, 20-year-old signalling systems, they're complex and they go wrong. But what else is a key factor is the fact that the railway is absolutely bursting at the seams. It's crammed to capacity. So when something goes wrong somewhere, it has huge knock-on effects all the way down the line, if you'll forgive the pun, you know, because the railway is so busy and there isn't that capacity to sort of accommodate, you know, trains on a different route or on a different line if the thing's too busy, because you just can't do that.
Okay, all right. So tell me about how will nationalisation of Southwestern Railways help me, the commuter, who's actually paying for everybody's wages out of my tax?
Well, in the very short term, it will help you because the railway will continue to run. if the franchisee just walks away, there's no trains.
Right.
So the government is forced to, they call it the operator of last resource. They're forced to actually get a different body in to run the railways as an interim. Now, as for the sort of, you know, the economic or political case for nationalisation, no doubt you'll be opposed to it. There is no doubt that the franchising system in its current form isn't really working very well.
How does it work then, Bruce? Well, why franchises work, you know, all in lots of different industries. What doesn't work in this particular case?
Well, it's rather complex. I mean, I suppose the evidence is in the proof is in the pudding, as it were. You know, the East Coast Main Line has failed three times, and on that basis, you know, you can say it isn't working. And also, you know, is our railway cheap and efficient? Clearly, franchising, you know, based on your experience, hasn't had a transformational effect on Southwestern, has it? You know, the reasons are very complex. One of which is that you're going to offer it out to the lowest bidder, which sort of means that the lowest amount of costs, but also the lowest amount of resources available to run that railway. So you'll have the fewest amount of spare staff available. The other problem is that you have to be able to forecast passenger numbers because the franchisee is taking on the risk and the reward of the revenue that it gets from selling tickets.
But that's one of the big issues, isn't it? In this case, thanks to those disgusting people at RMT, this last year, I mean, it's not the only reason. Signalling is a massive reason, right? But the RMT strike, right, really damaged two things. One, the number of trains running, but also whether you decided then to travel at all in 2019, because you could not be sure that there wasn't some strike that you didn't know anything about that was going to cause these delays.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. You know, this whole strike has reflected very badly on the railway industry as a whole. Where I disagree with you, though, is, you know, you are putting the blame firmly with the RMT. You know, our position is it's a plague on both their houses, because this issue about the role of the guards and so on has been resolved on other franchises and on other lines. So there is a solution out there.
What was the solution, Bruce? It was actually throwing their hand in, wasn't it?
What do you mean by that?
What they said was, okay, in the end of the day, we'll give you a job for life. You can carry on opening.
No, I don't think that is true. You know, this is about running the railway in a modern way where the driver can take on the role of shutting the doors.
And
that has happened. There are railways, I mean, the Tube's a good example, you know, where there is no guard. So an agreement is possible. Reading between the lines, I might be wrong on this, but this is my guess about what's happening, is that the they've said, yeah, we'll keep the guards, we'll let the drivers open the doors. In exceptional circumstances, we'll run the train with just the driver. And I suspect that the RMT thinks that's the thin end of the wedge, and exceptional circumstances will become occasional and normal and regular. And, you know, it's sort of removing the guards by stealth. That's my suspicion. I don't know that for definite. But
Bruce, I'm very surprised. You don't need the guards, do you? I mean, unless you want to check people's tickets, which I do understand, you don't need them for anything else. Most of the ones I see go into their little cubbyhole halfway down the train, right, and stay in it for the whole thing. And in the morning, they stay in it because they can't move up and down because the trains are too packed.
Well, indeed, yeah. I slightly disagree with you. It's certainly true that the travelling public like to have that sort of human presence on the train, and guards do have a very important, you know, safety role, and that is reflected in the fact that we have an exceptionally safe railway, one of the safest in Europe. But you know, it's horses for courses on this. It depends on the level of staffing at the stations. So if you have fully staffed stations with, you know, a fairly short stopping service, like on the Tube, then it's okay to do away with the guards. But if you're talking about, you know, different sort of services where there's unstaffed stations, then I think it's important that we retain the guards. We do have to have that human presence, I think.
OK, well, that's fine, Bruce, because actually the management at SWR, useless that they are, have said that we aren't trying to lay anybody off anyway. They can stay on. But in the long run, none of us are guaranteed jobs. I don't know about you, Bruce. I certainly am. And the only reason I started the radio station is nobody else would employ me. You know, yeah, so... So,
can I just say, Kelvin, you know, you were talking about working from home. You haven't built a studio at home?
Do you know what? I was thinking of doing it. I was thinking of doing it. Instead of that, I put an extension up. Anyway, Bruce, it's very good to speak to you. That's Bruce Williamson of Rail Future.